listening to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, David and Nikki Nellis. We're glad to be back here with you, broadcasting from our fabulous glassed-in studio here in the even more fabulous Line Hotel, the Sheik.
Want to mention anything about Thanksgiving or
Line
like
Hotel?
A
well,
nice
I'm doing the intro. Why are
holiday
you
holiday that we had?
You're killing my buzz, man. Let's back off. So we're back from Thanksgiving. We had an intimate Thanksgiving with 4,000 members of our family up in Philadelphia, and I'm sitting on my extra 15 pounds. This is great. I'm sitting on two turkeys, or it looks like that. But we're here and we're back, and Nikki is her usual svelte, gorgeous self, because that's Nikki. Mm-hmm. And we're talking tonight about a really interesting subject. Our very good friend Robert Hike is the founder and CEO of G&B Importers. They import nothing but Bulgarian wines. And some of you might say, Bulgarian wines, I love them. Some of you might say, Bulgaria makes wines. Bulgaria has been making wine for only 6,000 years, so if you don't know that, you don't know nothing.
Well, actually, I don't think that's a helpful way of explaining it to people who may know about some wines but may not know about the history of wine.
Well, they're going to find out.
I think that's kind of off-putting.
You mean snotty? You think I'm being snotty?
I think you're being snotty because I think you, of all people, wouldn't have the
well,
first clue.
Well, it takes a snot to know a snot.
Well, I mean, but you wouldn't know anything about Bulgarian
wine. I happen to know a great deal about
Bulgarian
wine. Well,
you do now because we're doing a show on it.
No, I knew about it before.
Yeah.
Back,
because we did another show on it.
Okay, okay. What parallel does the Thracian Valley
sit on? Something with the Willamette Valley.
There you go.
Okay, no.
Willamette, but anyways. All right, so Robert, enough of that. It's like family court.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we kind of start with you and your background and how you fell in love with Bulgarian wines, first and foremost.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You think.
Again.
Great, we just got started.
And this is awesome. Well, when I left finance, I always dreamt of having my own business. And it was supposed to be related to food and agriculture because while I was in investments, I always considered drinking and eating sort of a forever business. And I went to Bulgaria because Bulgaria, you know, occupies a special place in my heart. I used to work there for the U.S. Embassy in the early 1990s. And it also housed my family and became sort of a home for us during the war in my own country at the time, in Armenia. It provided shelter, it provided lights, it provided energy and opportunity. So I definitely fell in love with the country. People are amazing. Food is stunning. And, of course, my first thought was, I need to do something with Bulgaria.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back, and it's a largely agricultural country, if you know about it. Almost 60% of land is agricultural. They are one of the largest producers, actually the largest producer of rose oil, rose petals, and lavender fields. One of the largest producers, lavender as well, honey. So they do a lot of things. But then wine was sort of pitched to me. They said, listen, you know, we're losing markets. We're one of the biggest producers, used to be one of the biggest producers in Europe. But we're losing markets, and it is an amazing product that we have, and we need help.
But why do you think that is? Because we did a little homework, and as you know, I mean, it's one of the original winemakers of the world. They started making
yes.
wine back in 4000 BCE, and for a long time, even in, what, did I say something wrong?
No, I believe I said that, and you told me how do I know, but
okay.
Yes.
But, I mean, because I read it to you. But one of the things that we did some research about was that up until the 1970s, Bulgarian wine was very well respected and very well known, and then sort of like after the fall of communism, there just was this decline in the availability, I guess, of wine, and then that education sort of died away. What do you think happened?
Well, you're very correct on a lot of the points.
Mm-hmm.
So up until 1994, Bulgaria actually was considered, by numbers, the second largest exporter of bottled wine after France. So they used to produce a ton of wine. But most of it was low quality, and it was mostly destined for the Warsaw Pact countries, mostly Russia. Mm-hmm. So, but obviously, after the fall of the Soviet Union, they went through a very difficult transition where they had to privatize, kind of find their footing. And then 2005, they joined EU. Mm-hmm. And that was the huge prompt to a lot of investments from France and Italy that came in, recognized the raw product, which is the grape. And as you know, we discussed this while ago, one of our first encounters with the concept of grape and a quality grape was, if you don't have good quality grapes, you can't make good quality wine.
Right.
Period. I mean, you can do shenanigans, you can do formulaic wine, but if you truly want to produce quality wine, you need quality grapes. And a country is abundantly filled with quality grapes, especially international varietals. So a lot of money came in, a lot of technology advancement came in, and now Bulgaria is producing absolutely stunning wines. I mean, over the past 10 years, even, I've noticed since we started working with Bulgarian wine and with our brands producing our own wine, we noticed a tremendous shift in quality and premiumization, as they call it, going from large mass production of, you know, low to mid quality wine that was basically destined for the lower shelves of the world, including UK, Scandinavia, Asia, etc. They now are going for lower quantities, trying to emphasize terroir, trying to emphasize the microclimates, trying to emphasize the uniqueness of each region of Bulgaria, and producing some absolutely stunning wines.
Well, so how does that get into play? So was there an education uptick for the people who owned the vineyards? How was that something that came from the government, or how did that, I mean, there must have been an infusion of money, but for people who were making cheap wine for years and years and years, how was it sold to them that they should increase the quality of their product in order to make more money?
Great question.
I am full of really good questions.
I know.
It's really what I do.
Oh my God, I'm going to fall over.
Okay.
Well, it's truly an important question. It's a great question because it goes to the heart of why Bulgaria is so good and why people should actually pay attention, because it is the next up-and-coming region that has the tremendous potential. They have an enology school that was established in, you know, turn of the 20th century. And it was established prompted by French enologist specialists who came in the beginning of 20th century to Bulgaria to help them to fight phylloxera. It was a huge breakout. They lost a lot of the crops, but he came in, and with his influence, they established an institute for enology and viticulture in Pleven, which is one of the biggest cities in Bulgaria. Mm-hmm. So they have a tremendous cadre that came in through all the way through Soviet times. And while they were making sort of large mass production of low-quality wine, there were no strangers to quality wines because they were selling. They quickly recognized, Soviets quickly recognized that this is a hard currency, mm-hmm. and they can sell it to, for example, Scandinavia, or they can sell it to Benelux countries, or they can sell it UK. Tesco's, one of the most successful Tesco private brands, was called Bulgarian Cabernet Reserve. Okay. And it's for years, they've been doing phenomenally well. So it's funny when we do tastings and promotions, anybody who's from UK or from Great Britain, they'll be like, oh yeah, Bulgarian wine. Of course, I love it. But so they
but not here,
no.
Not in the US.
US had a short stint in 1980s. PepsiCo wanted to get its concentrate to Soviet bloc. Mm-hmm. And one of the deals they made, they said, okay, what do you want us? And the Soviets said, you got to take Bulgarian wine.
That's funny.
And they looked at it. They said, okay, quality is good, price is good. So they did a barter, literally. Mm-hmm. Concentrate from PepsiCo to Soviets and Bulgarian wine to the States. They used to sell Southern wine and spirits. When we met with them about 6 years ago, one of their oldest sort of salespeople, who was a regional manager, said, oh gosh, I remember we used to sell heck out of this stuff, like 2,000 cases a month or something crazy like that. It was costing like $6.
But did they not get widespread? I mean,
no.
The Soviet bloc was always portrayed as just kind of gray and monolithic here. So,
well, it was.
Right, right. But so, the thought of anything really sort of sexy coming out of there is sort of antithetical to that. I mean, their cars look like cinder blocks with wheels. the women's clothing looked like, you know, cinder blocks with holes in for the arms. I mean, yes, it was bad.
It was largely a sad story.
Yeah, sad.
Very
stuff.
Gray. Very
so,
gray.
So is that really what the problem was? It was just sort of hard. Because, look, you know, Bulgarians in American films during that time, they were all cinder block guys with dark coats, and they were all hitmen. I mean, that's what that was, Bulgaria.
Yeah, that's, I know, it's unfortunate, and it all was mixed up into this, you know, like Warsaw Pact block of, like, spies and, you know, just, or weird-looking shot put women from, you know, Eastern Germany competing in Olympics. But actually...
they were men. Come on.
But actually, Bulgaria has amazingly beautiful women, just like any other Eastern European country.
Right.
But... the grayness, I think, obviously, during Soviet times, while it was gray and sad, and they did mostly what the Soviet, what the Moscow told them to do, and they would say, you know, send me 10 million liters of this, or Traminer.
Thunderbird.
Traminer, or bear blood, and they would do that. Hungary used to send bull's blood. I mean, it was this.
Bull's blood was big here, though. Everybody thought bull's blood was like premium wine.
When was that?
Back in the like the 60s and 70s,
okay.
Yeah,
absolutely. Okay.
And a lot of the older generation always says, "Ooh, is this like the bear blood?" I'm like, "No, my God, we've graduated from that." But the point I'm trying to make is, I think Nick's question is like, how did they how did they learn to do this? They knew how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
The Institute of Enology was so advanced that they created actually varietals like Rubin. One of the varietals in this Imperial Red blend is called Rubin. Rubin is a crisscross of Nebbiolo and Syrah. It's a fantastic grape varietal, and it was designed in 40s and 50s,
mm-hmm.
kind of on a cusp of the, you know, war ending and the Soviets coming and occupying.
Well, wait, so before we... I guess my question is, you know, I think one of the issues people have with wines from Bulgaria or wines from Georgia, you know, wines from mm-hmm. some of these regions, is that they're not grape varietals that people are familiar with because the names are different, right? So explaining what the comparison, like if you like a Sauv Blanc from California, right, or New Zealand, two very different, like if you were to do, you know, France, Sauv Blanc, from France or California or New Zealand, you know, if somebody says, I only like them from France, you know what they like because you know the different profiles.
Right.
So I guess to me, one of the hard parts is explaining to people the grape varietals that are coming out of Bulgaria and how they relate to an American's taste palate.
Fantastic point. I mean, that was the cornerstone.
Stop telling her every point
relax,
is fantastic.
Relax. That's what happens when you sit in the low seat, right?
Okay. You get neglected.
Sit on you in a minute.
So the point... I think it's important because when we were considering, we're mm-hmm. going to bring Bulgarian wine.
Right.
And obviously they have indigenous varietals that are fantastic. One of mm-hmm. them is Mavrut, Gamza, and Rubin. And I'm going to speak about those three in relation to what you just asked. But of course, we also looked at the international varietals,
mm-hmm.
which strangely enough in Bulgaria dominate the acreage of planted vineyards.
Okay.
The largest, largest planting in Bulgaria is Merlot. And it is absolutely stunning Merlot. Unfortunately, it's been, you know, much maligned after the Sideways movie. But I mean, it's a.
How do you say Sideways in Bulgarian?
That's difficult.
But people are still drinking Merlot.
Of course, of course they drink. But the stigma is still there.
I know he really like that one line.
I know,
has really tanked an entire wine varietal.
But you know what's funny?
But now everybody wants to drink Pinot Noir.
Of course. But the funny thing is that the ending scene, or one of the ending scenes, when he's sitting in the McDonald's eating a Big Mac.
Right.
What is he drinking? He's drinking Bordeaux. Merlot-based Bordeaux.
Right, of course.
It's like, it's hilarious because it's like, but nevertheless, I mean, the purpose of
but
the movie...
But I digress.
But Bulgaria has truly embraced international varietals largely because it just did very well. Merlot mm-hmm. and Cabernet are just thriving, especially in the South.
But the wines coming out of Bulgaria, is it a Merlot wine or is it a blended wine?
Generally speaking, majority of Europe makes blended wines. Okay. And Bulgaria is no different, but for our purposes, because, you know, California literally changed the mindset and the paradigm of the American drinkers by trying to differentiate itself from Europe and introduce single varietals.
Right.
So I said, okay, we're going to do that. So we wanted to introduce the American consumers to, first of all, wine drinkers to the region through something they're really familiar with, and they don't have to, you know, kill their tongue pronouncing something like, you know, Assyrtiko, like the Greek wines that's just slightly impronounceable.
Right.
So we decided, hey, we're going to bring the largest selling wine in the U.S., Cabernet.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to show them the quality at the price that is tremendously affordable, but the value is surpassing whatever else they're paying.
Okay.
And then Merlot, and then Sauvignon Blanc, and then Chardonnay. And then slowly, slowly, we're going to introduce them to fantastic local indigenous varietals that Bulgaria is full of.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is Gamza, for example.
Okay,
Gamza.
This is the Merlot?
Yeah, that's the Merlot.
Okay.
And by the way, the label, I have to tell you a couple things about the label.
The label is stunning. It's so pretty.
I know. It's actually, when we were developing the concept of the label, we had this kind of an idea in mind, and I always pictured sort of like Nora O'Donnell, like who would be drinking? Someone who's sophisticated, ambitious, successful.
Sure. Oh, she's not that sophisticated.
Oh, she is too.
And when I showed, so we were at the restaurant, and I showed this to Jeff and Nora.
Oh, Chef Jeff's,
And she said, oh, gosh, this reminds me of the studs around my Valentino shoes, you know.
Right.
And also she said, hey, Byzantine Cross, this is a license from God to drink. I'm all in.
Oh, that's
so it's sort of like she gave her a seal of approval. And also I have to mention that Chef Jeff and Jeff Tracy, they were one of the earliest adapters of and believers into Bulgarian wine. And to this day, once we started with them about 4 years ago, their house wines is our Bulgarian Cabernet and Chardonnay.
Well, that sort of brings me to the point I wanted to make because, all right, you've got Bulgaria that's sort of behind the Iron Curtain and things dip down after the Iron Curtain falls and all that. Meanwhile, for really since the 60s, the French and the Italian have been marketing the crap out of their wines.
Yeah. And California. And then California.
And California as well. And so your two biggest enemies are marketing budgets, a phrase dear to my heart, of course, and time. Because in order to, you know, it's, you know, the waves against the shore.
Well, actually, and I think you're missing some other instances because, quite frankly, you also have, so it used to be France and Italy. And then it was, and then California got added to the mix. And now you have,
New Zealand,
Australia,
Spain,
and South American wines, obviously, Chilean, Argentina.
Right. But my point,
you're going to have to let me finish.
No, you're going to have
but
to let
the
me
thing
finish.
Is that, like I look at, the wines of, Provence. Yeah. So 15 years ago, they made a concerted effort with their money to make rosé the most drinkable wine.
Yeah.
And 15 years ago, nobody in the United States was drinking rosé. And when they first started pulling out those bottles of rosé, people were like, oh my God, people are drinking White Zinfandel, you know, that sugary, sweet stuff. And now the Washington, D.C. area drinks more rosé than anywhere else in the country.
That's amazing.
So you just made my point. My point is,
has
the commercial office at the Bulgarian embassy or have the Bulgarian producers gotten behind a program to generate the awareness and the interest and, you know, the engagement that is necessary?
What a painful topic.
Are you a voice crying in the wilderness? I mean, you've done very well. We have to mention that some of Robert's wines are, you know, they're in the finest restaurants. They're in the finest wine stores. He also has a line of wines called Rough Day, which are very drinkable.
Well, he's going to get to all
that. But
wait
a minute, whoa, that are in Walmart and Costco. I mean, it's not like you're some small dude stuck in a little office somewhere. You're doing fine.
Well, we're still a small dude when it comes to, and obviously we are very ambitious and I'm not asking too much, like 0.5% of the U.S. market, 40 million bottles. But
and I just want to be
so
your best friend.
When you brought it into Chef Jeff's, right, did you have to educate him and his staff on the wines and the wines of Bulgaria?
Absolutely. And but also this is like there are two categories. The pioneers, who sort of like, of course you still have to persuade them, but they are Can I say ballsy?
Yeah, they're ballsy.
Yes.
It's the internet. You can say testically.
They're extremely courageous when it comes to making a leap and saying, hey, quality is there. Why not? Let's do it. And Jeff was like, absolutely, we're going to do this. Price point is fantastic. Quality is tremendous. Let's do it. And it's unique and it's differentiating point. Mm-hmm. Same thing, Total Wine. Total Wine was the earliest adopters and we have to hand it to them. You know, even though I knocked on the door for about a year, but you know what? I knocked on the doors of a lot of people for a year. Nobody responded. Mm-hmm. Total Wine said, we're going to take it. We're going to take a shot at this. And so, and then you have the ones who are sort of like the followers, like Costco. It's a fantastic partner, you know, locally, and their buyer, Siobhan Clemens, who sort of does that Northeast. She took a look at it, and Costco is not in a business of building brands, but they were also courageous enough to take this Imperial Red blend, which, by the way,
that's Bulgariana
Imperial mm-hmm. Red, has 89 points from Robert Parker, by the way.
Right.
It sells for $6.99 at Costco.
Oh, my God.
It's, I mean, it takes 4 years to release this bottle, and people look at it and like, oh, my God.
I mean, it looks like a very expensive bottle of
wine. It's very expensive. The problem is, obviously, this was a one-time deal. Always people say, oh, you killed the brand. I'm like, look, first of all, we were a small growing company. Costco comes in and says, I'm going to buy all of it.
You're going to do it.
Of course you're going to do it.
Of course.
It's like Walmart did with that Malbec a couple of years back for $7, 93 points from
Wine Advocate. Right, from Argentina, right.
Yeah, and people are like, how is it possible? Well, they come in, they make an offer you can't refuse, especially. And that goes to the heart of Dave's point.
Sure.
There's no money in Bulgaria. It's a poor European Union country, one of the poorest along with along with Romania. They're trying to do it. And EU does a lot of subsidies also to help those countries that are rich in certain agricultural products, such as wine, to cultivate, to promote. But those are minuscule works. I mean, mm-hmm. they pale in comparison to what Rioja does. Rioja spends close to $50,000-$60,000 a year just on Total Wine.
Right, I bet.
Wines of Portugal does the same thing. I mean, I can't say Portugal is an extremely rich country, but they have made a concerted effort to create a marketing push and support the industry to get onto the largest and fastest growing market, which is the United States. Bulgaria cannot do that. And we are sort of kind of like the lone voice crying in the desert, but there are a lot of people are starting to get on our wagon.
Well, I think the hardest thing to, I feel like it's a double-edged sword, right? If you sell for really cheap, you have those people who are like, oh, great, a bottle of red for, you know, $7.
Correct.
I'm going to buy that. And then you have the other people who are like, well, then wines from Bulgaria are just cheap wines,
right?
So listen, what you did makes all the sense in the world because it does start the education process. But I think where you probably find the best advantage is by getting your wines into restaurants where people who drink wine talk to their wait staff or the GM or their somm, and the somm says, this is a really good wine.
So how many restaurants are you in major markets?
I mean, we're in D.C. The restaurants mostly we cover, we have placements in, are in D.C.
Okay.
So in Chicago, we are our Rough Day is doing phenomenally well in Chicago, and they're starting to get into the restaurant by the glass programs, but they're still trying to saturate retail.
Sure.
Even though, generally, yes, by law, not by law, but rule of thumb, you go from on-premise, which is restaurants, to off-premise, to retailers, but they're doing successfully the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some of the, I can't read without my glasses, actually my marketing.
You want me to read it for you?
Yeah, there are important restaurants that, obviously Chef Jeff was the early adopter, but it's under their own label.
Mm-hmm.
We have Milena.
All right. I mean, these are some great stores. You're in MacArthur, Calvert Woodley, Cleveland Park Wine and Spirits, Cork and Fork.
Yeah,
and
those are
Total Wine.
Yeah, those are like big, important accounts that truly believed in us when everybody was laughing at us.
So is your marketing strategy sort of Washington first and then Chicago or Atlanta or wherever?
Yeah, when we started, we were based in Washington, D.C. We started with Southern about 4 or 5 years ago, and we quickly realized it's not going to work, not because Southern is not a good company, but because we're just too small of a fish, very low on a totem pole, nobody pays attention. So we decided to do self-distribution. Mm-hmm. So that was, and then we basically went and knocked on everybody's doors, like finewine.com with Cecile in Montgomery County, Wine Harvest with Andy. Those are like people who, Jeff Tracy with Chef, they kind of like gave us a little bit of this wing and a power to believe in us and continue to believe in ourselves that we're doing the right thing because the wine is selling and selling very well. So
that's funny.
Okay, well, I think what we should do now is take a quick break. And then when we come back, what I think what people would be interested in learning about is the actual grapes, the varietals.
Awesome.
And what their taste profile is. And then we can try some of the wines and discuss them on air. How
Fantastic.
Does that work for you? Okay,
Fantastic.
Great. This is David and Nikki Nellis with Industry Night. We're talking about wines from Bulgaria. If you haven't tried them, you're missing out. We'll be back in just a sec.
Now, I guess we're just going to have to break it down for you. Rock the beat. Rock the beat.
All right, we're back on Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, David and Nikki Nellis. Our guest tonight is Robert Hajk, who is the CEO and founder of G&B Importers, exclusively importing a range of really fabulous Bulgarian wines. And we're learning why Bulgaria is an area not to be missed if you're a wine lover or if you're if you like to experiment and you like to sort of drink around the world.
Well, honestly, actually, what we're getting to do right now is we're getting a wine tasting in studio, lucky us. And Robert is going to pour a variety of some of the different grapes that are grown in the Bulgarian regions. And some of them are very familiar, like Merlot, and some of them are grapes that maybe you haven't heard of, but he's going to explain the profiles to us, what we should be looking for. And I'd love to hear a little bit about the growers and sort of the relationships you have with them and how these wines sort of come to be. So I know we're starting with the Merlot, which, oh my God, I can totally smell it from here. So tell us a little bit about this Merlot. We know it has a gorgeous label, but tell us about what we're looking for here and a little bit about the terroir.
Awesome. So Merlot, as I mentioned, this is the most widely planted grape varietal in Bulgaria. And the reason for that is it just does phenomenally well. The quality of this Merlot is stunning. And sometimes it pains me that we're struggling to convince the retailers and restaurant owners to take it on because it's truly an amazing varietal, period. and this particular Merlot from this particular area, which is the Thracian Valley, south of Bulgaria.
Mm-hmm.
So to give you a little bit of an idea...
But wait, I'm sorry to interrupt, but have they always been growing Merlot?
Since the 1910, 1915.
Okay.
So turn of the century.
Okay.
But obviously before that, yeah, the older, older international varietals came into Bulgaria in sort of in greater force in 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
But they started to introduce Merlot and Cabernet early in the century. So what are you going to feel? You're going to feel a lot of cherry on this one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A little bit of tobacco. And if you age this, you're definitely going to feel leather, very earthy. So
what year is this?
This is 2015.
Okay.
And the characteristics, first of all, it's, you know, Bulgaria generally has a continental climate.
Okay.
As Dave mentioned, it's between 41st and 44th parallel, which really encompasses all the best wine regions from Tuscany, Piemont, Bordeaux, Napa, Willamette, etc. And soil is on the south, mostly black forest, very clayish, kind of like nutrient field, but not too, what's the word I'm looking for?
Dense, not too dense.
And the grape has to fight. Mm-hmm. So the vines have to fight for nutrients and for...
is that classic Merlot? Does Merlot normally, is it a tough vine, Merlot? Does it normally have to fight to survive? Or that's just how it is in Bulgaria with this particular grape?
Or does that make
grape?
It a richer grape?
It makes a richer grape. So less.
Very good.
Less,
thank you. A plus.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Dave, absolutely. And you, that lower seat is not heating.
That's right, but I'm tall now.
Okay.
No, it's true. It's I mean, the lushness and complexity and aromas all come from stress,
mm-hmm.
and obviously stress within limits. And just like human beings, you know,
right,
more stress you go
say.
Through.
Yeah,
right.
Some of the people I work with are
they're
aromas.
Merlots. You can start calling them Merlots.
What an aroma!
You're a Merlot.
Yeah.
And
no, you're a Merlot.
That's right. This is a very typical Bordeaux-style Merlot. A little bit more fruit because Bordeaux Merlot is kind of generally drier, on a drier
it's
side.
A little bit, yes. This is fuller.
This is fuller because the climate is just a tiny bit hotter, a little bit more sunny days.
Mm-hmm.
So you get slightly higher alcohol. But of course, the job of the enologist and the winemaker to tame it and to tame the tannins and make it palatable without necessarily making it a formulaic wine and taking the essence away from it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, this Merlot is just absolutely fabulous. And this is a straight, you know, straight varietal. There's no blends.
Okay, so this, and what is the name of this bottle?
It's the K-Sellers Merlot.
Okay, the K-Sellers Merlot. And this can be found around the D.C. area?
Pretty much, yeah. Although, as I said, we struggle to persuade retailers because the common response we get, like, Merlot, it's hard to sell, you know, man. And then people, of course, the region is another impediment.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about the marketing. I think it's we can't stress that enough. And we are obviously putting our own money. We're spending our own efforts. And we're trying to promote the country and the region. But we need a little bit more in that arena because... people just have to be a little bit more open-minded. You know, I don't mind you drinking Apothic or Kendall Jackson for the rest of your life, but venture out. Try this. It's a shame for anybody who loves wine
mm-hmm.
to say, I'm not going to try it, because it's a capable region, been producing forever. You can't even call it an old world because it's truly an ancient world.
Right.
So not to try it, it's just intellectually or just... not being uncurious.
Well, I think people are, when it comes to wine, I believe that a lot of people stick to what they know because they're afraid of looking stupid, right?
Of course.
So, you know, what?
I'm just laughing at that. I've never been afraid of looking stupid.
Yeah, so. No, that's like one of your positive points, I guess. Because you're a Merlot.
No, you're a Merlot.
Okay. But so I think that's one of the reasons why people stick to... whatever it is that they drink is because they're afraid.
You know what? You go to college and drink 7 and 7s and you drink it all your life because you look like something when you go to the bar and like you're ordering or a Maker's Mark. That's what it is. People are.
I think people like to stick with what they know because they're afraid of either looking stupid. The thing I always say to people is if you try it, and you don't like it, send it back. Or you always ask for a taste, right? Especially with so many by the glass availabilities. And plus, you guys do tastings all over the place.
Of course, absolutely.
And, you know, if you talk to any wine store person or, you know, in a restaurant, 9 times out of 10, not always. I've definitely had people pour me wine who did not know what they were doing. But 9 times out of 10, you're going to get somebody who's like, yeah, let me give you a taste of that. Let me tell you about it. And if they can't tell you about it, they'll bring somebody to tell you about it. So, okay, let's go to the next grape. What are we trying next?
Next, I want you to try pure Bulgarian indigenous varietal, which is Gamza. Gamza is also known as Kadarka.
Spell it. Gamza?
G-A-M-Z-A.
Oh, Gamza.
Gamza. Okay. Okay, Gamza. And what can you compare this to? What's its profile like? Thank you.
So Gamza is like, think of a Beaujolais. Mm-hmm. Think of a Gamay. It's a very sort of a light, peppery, with a very long-lasting finish.
Oh my God, this is delicious.
This is delicious. Gamza.
No. And you know,
he's like, I know, I'm buy trying it, to would tell you. Please?
Gamza.
What's the matter with you people?
It's the only place we sell Gamza in this area is Total Wine. And this is, by the way, just to let you know, Gamza is the first Bulgarian indigenous varietal that got rated, I think, was number 20 or something on last year's top 100 best buys by wine enthusiasts. It's a big deal. 89 yeah. points from a wine, for a wine that cost $9.99. I mean,
that's nuts.
I mean, it's really fascinating that this is a $10 wine.
Can I ask you a exactly. dumb question?
Yes, of course. There are no dumb questions.
He has a lot of.
Why did I get married, Robert? Mm-hmm. No. Why not? You know, in my world, it's often said sometimes people appreciate something if they have to pay more than they want to for. If they have to sort of squeeze, why not double the price? I mean, why not make it more?
No, so that, I totally disagree with that.
Well,
assessment.
You can disagree with
so
it.
So let me just tell
I'm
you
asking
something.
Robert
I know, but let me just tell you, because I think Robert would agree with me, a lot of wines, like if you look at South American wines and Australian wines, right, and New Zealand wines, they all enter the market with very inexpensive wines, and then incrementally over time,
but who gives
they
a
drive
shit?
It up a dollar.
No.
That's a strategy, although we should say that, like, Chile struggled and still mm-hmm. struggles to premiumize their wine because mm-hmm. they got stuck with Cacciatore.
So
wait, yeah, but I got to tell you, I mean, Wines of Chile is pushing it like nobody's business.
All right. I agree with you.
Hello.
Pushing it.
But this is $9.99. Is that what you said?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. So what if it was a $16.99 bottle? People would have more respect for it.
But okay, I'm going to counter that. So here's the other issue. Look at wines from Virginia. Okay. And now, I mean, I'm just bringing this up because both you and I know that, and you must know this as well, Robert, you know, everybody wants something local, right? Local right. beers, local right. distilleries, local, I mean, local wines are supposed to be very hot. But the wines from Virginia that are $60, let's say,
right.
people are like, fuck that. I'm not paying $60 for a wine from Virginia. People are not going to, there's a perception level of what something should cost.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Okay.
Yes.
It's no different than buying, you know, a case of Genesee beer for $6.99.
I don't
know
what Genesee beer
is. I'm saying, you know, you devalue it automatically by the fact that it's not just even affordable, it's cheap as shit. If that's the problem, I mean, part of the whole thing is perception.
I don't know. So the wine is very good, by the way.
This wine is terrific.
I think, Dave,
Alexia,
you're right.
What do you think? She gives us a thumbs
up. An extremely...
Watch it.
Point.
She's flying the ship. So,
and Nikki, I have to agree.
Well, go ahead, Robert. Come on, baby.
No, I have to agree with you because let me tell you why.
Mm-hmm.
You know how many people walked in? We used to do, obviously, Costco bought shitload of it and said, can you come in and do in-store
tastings?
You can do tastings, but you do dry tastings.
Right.
Sort of introductions. I said, of
course. Oh, wait. You can't pour it?
No, you can't pour in Costco. They don't allow. Because you can imagine the mayhem, checking the licenses.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
So people would come in Arlington, which is the snootiest, you know, Costco.
Oh, you haven't been to Bethesda.
There is no Costco in Bethesda.
I mean, we're talking about Costco in Arlington.
Wheaton.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not snooty in Wheaton.
People will pick up the bottle. And I'll be like, oh, I mean, $6.99. I don't drink anything under $10. I'm sorry.
Right.
I'm like, well, okay, but just Robert Parker gave 89 points.
Yeah, but half
this is Costco. They don't mark up as anybody else. Like, those components need to tell you that this, there has to be a value.
And when you say Robert Parker gave it 89 points, they say what? Who's Robert Parker?
No, they don't, but they're still very skeptical because of the price.
Well,
but
that's what I said to you. Right, so that's what I said to you earlier.
Up the price.
He can't up the price at Costco. But, so that's what they want to sell it for.
Let's talk about the Gamza price. It's a very important point.
Okay, so which one? This one, the one we really like, the Gamza.
Okay, $10, $11, let's say between $9.99, $10.99, $11.99, depending who marks up what. I believe, and our company believes, that you can't gouge, okay? Producer makes money, our farmers make money, we make money, and a consumer gets a fantastic wine that is truly of value and gets a lot of utility out of what he paid for.
Mm-hmm.
That's our goal. I don't want them to be like, oh, yeah, it's $19.99, it must be good. No, it's a $10 bottle, but it tastes like $15 bottle or $16 bottle. Try it, enjoy it.
I have to be honest. It tastes like a more expensive wine. It does. It has a. It's very full bodied, but it's not overpowering. You could drink this with hors d'oeuvres, or you know, like
absolutely.
It's a. You know, whereas the Merlot, you need to eat that with dinner.
Absolutely.
Whereas this wine, this can go anywhere.
I call it Netflix and popcorn.
Yeah, I mean, wine. It's an easy drinking red wine. You know, any time of day. You could even put a little chill on it. You know, if you wanted to serve it like. In the spring or summer. I mean, it's, you know, like a Gamay. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. And that's, you know, the Gamza name originates from Arabic, sort of like loosely means like difficult woman or capricious woman.
You are a Gamza.
But
Gamza, Gamza, Gamza.
But what they,
thank you, Robert.
What they tried with that to explain is like, it's a difficult grape. It takes a lot of care, mm-hmm. but at the same time, it offers so much elegance and so much complexity and so mm-hmm. much depth. So, I mean, and it grows in northern parts of Bulgaria, and it's in D.C. in Maryland, is distributed by our fantastic distributors, global distributors.
Okay.
And they do a little bit of this in a county, but mostly in Virginia and everywhere else it's sold, only through Total Wine. And they took this nationwide. And mind you, they tasted once. And they said, we have no idea what this is. This is an amazing wine. We don't know where to stick it because it's not like a blend. They don't have a single varietal Gamza section.
Sure.
So they stuck it in the back of the store, which is with other reds. And I said, it's okay. It will stand out. It will prove itself. And it did. I mean, Northern Virginia Total Wine stores cannot keep up with this.
Well, you know, when David Trone was interviewed, they said, to what do you owe your election? He said, Gamza.
Yeah.
No, that's really interesting. Because I think, like a store, Costco is one. I mean, Costco's a different animal. So, I mean, it's not even a point of discussing it.
I agree.
A store like Total Wine, you're really at the mercy of the people who work there. And if they like you and they like their wine, they're going to sell it.
Oh, you're absolutely correct. You hit it on the head. Mm-hmm. It's there is corporate decisions made all the time,
mm-hmm.
you know, Total Wine and not David Trone, obviously, but his team, our buyers can say, yeah, we like this wine. Let's buy two containers of this. Hey, fantastic. They're going to put it on a shelf and it's mm-hmm. going to collect dust. Unless it's already, the brand has already have a following. We are lucky because our Cabernet, Bulgarian Cabernet mm-hmm. is such a big hit with them. Even in states I've never visited, like Minnesota, we get emails saying, this is an amazing wine for $11.99. Are you kidding me? It's like a $20 Bordeaux. But so because of the following, I think people also say, I'm going to give it a try because it's the same brand.
Sure.
Let's see what it is.
Okay, so let's tell people again. This is a Bulgariana.
Bulgariana brand, mm-hmm. and it's a Gamza is the varietal.
Gamza.
G-A-M-Z-A.
And it's similar to a Gamay?
Gamay or Pinot Noir. It's somewhere in that, like, it's right. It drinks like a good Beaujolais.
Okay, that's very fair, because you do have a Pinot Noir.
Correct.
Which just got some nice press
from Dave McIntyre.
Well, so explain to people what three stars means from Dave McIntyre.
It means it's awesome. Well,
it means it's amazing.
It's three stars out of three stars. He
right.
actually is very stingy, generally speaking, and he's...
And that's a compliment, Dave. That is not a criticism.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. He's stingy with his, because he's truly.
He means judicious.
Yes, judicious. Absolutely.
And I love the fact, because we go back and forth with Dave. Sometimes I remember he tasted a couple of the wines and he would say, I don't feel the terroir. I don't feel the specificity. It was like a couple of years ago. And I was like, Dave, we're working towards it. We're trying to bring wine that truly reflects what, let's say, Danube area of Bulgaria, which is the northern part on the border of Romania and the Danube River, can truly produce. And his remarks on Milena were, I commend the winemaker for taking the juice and doing absolutely very little with that.
Mm-hmm.
And letting the 100% pure Pinot Noir be in its full glory.
So this is from the northern part of the country.
Northern part of the country.
Okay,
yes.
And it's a Pinot Noir.
It's 100% Pinot Noir.
100%.
No California shenanigans. We don't have Zinfandel or
There's
Merlot
in it.
There's no
mixes in there.
No.
Okay.
Well, Dave McIntyre also likes Rough Day.
Oh, yes, he does. He actually gave, I think, 2.5 stars to our cab.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And, now, Dave, speaking of one of the early sort of believers, he was the first guy who said, of course I will taste and rate Bulgarian wine. I was like, oh, my God, there's someone actually cares.
Right.
That's trying something new and interesting. And to your point, Nikki, I think, of course, we stick with familiar. Of course, it's the unknown. Like, if I want to spend $15, I want to buy something I already know. I don't want to experiment.
But people consider that a lot of money for a bottle of wine? Maybe I'm a dope.
The country, by and large, $15 is the mid-range. It's the majority of the sales are done.
See, when you get up
there is a reason why I don't send you out to buy wine, just to be clear.
I hate you. You're a gamza.
I'm just saying.
What
do you spend on a bottle of wine?
Well, it depends on what I'm buying. But when I see a bottle of wine, $45, $50, I start thinking, that's
not
ridiculous.
In a restaurant.
No, I'm talking about it like at...
you would buy a $45 bottle of wine. When?
If you sent me... Oh, my God.
I mean, I'm just asking.
You're horrible. You're horrible.
I'm honest.
We're getting into the...
You're horrible.
I'm honest. There's a difference.
Right now, our children are siding with me. No, I mean, if you said, you just said, pick up a great bottle of, I don't know, Pinot Noir or something, and I went into a liquor store and I was asking for help, I wouldn't consider like a $35 bottle of wine. I would say, like, that's pretty good. You know, if you start spending 60 or 70, you might as well be in a restaurant. But $15 for a bottle of wine,
you know, the restaurants mark up the bottle.
I hate you.
Right?
Stop talking.
I mean, I'm just saying.
You're talking.
Yeah, okay. $12.99, $14.99, $15.99.
Is that where the world is? Really?
Yeah, it's the world is. But also going
But also
into
you
the,
can, I think the point David is missing, listen, can you get fabulous bottles of wine for 60 plus?
Of course
you can. But there are really good value wines.
Of course.
That drink beautifully. And listen, not every bottle of wine you open has to be a $150 Chateau Neuf de Pape or,
no,
you know, a $600 bottle of wine. Sometimes you're just opening a bottle of wine to have a glass of wine with dinner, and it should be really good. It should be really drinkable. I mean, I think one of the things people say when they come back from Europe is, like when we were in Umbria, you know, the wine at the house we were staying at in Umbria
They had a little vineyard there.
Cost $7 a bottle. And it was delicious.
Exactly.
So I think it's about the American market. But I agree with you because, you know, when you think of like Trader Joe's, Costco, Walmart, people are looking for that wine between $10 and $25.
Well, as you said, Costco is a total different animal.
Yes.
They mark up 14%. Nobody can compete with that concept.
Right, of course.
And it's a different model. But generally speaking, yes, U.S. three-tier system just adds on and on by the time bottle gets to the hands of the consumer.
So are companies like yours trapped? Because that's not much of a markup. It's obviously a volume play. Are you trapped by shelving fees?
That's just Costco.
No, there are no shelving fees necessarily. We're trapped by the general perception, and Nikki is absolutely correct because people...
Stop saying that.
People perceive that... And sometimes they will say, how can the wine be so cheap? And we don't educate the consumer because you mentioned Virginia. It's a great example. But nobody asks, how much does the land in Virginia cost?
Right.
Acre in Virginia
versus what it costs
in Bulgaria.
That's such an incredible point because it's something that restaurateurs make all the time. Like when people are like, this restaurant costs X amount of dollars. And it's like, well, put the real estate in there. What are they paying per exactly. square foot? Mm-hmm. Right. It's, you know, it's not just what's on the plate. Correct. It's everything around you. And I think that's a very important point when we're talking about wines.
It's a crucial point, Nikki, because, I mean, I come from the world of finance. When I went into wine, I mean, I wasn't a huge drinker, but when I was looking at this and I was comparing, and then I realized when people say, oh, it's, you can't find good wine under $20. I'm like, yes, if you're buying California, you can't.
Right.
Average cost of California land, acre, good quality, Sonoma, Russian River, Napa, $240,000 an acre. Bordeaux, France, you know, if you combine on average, France is roughly at around 120, 140,000 euros per acre.
Right.
Bulgaria, $4,000. Of course, I mean, yes, everything else they pay through the nose.
We're moving to Bulgaria.
Electricity, water, labor is relatively cheap. But I try to educate people. I'm like, listen, guys, we're not trying to make a killing. We're trying to make a decent living, make sure that our producers are paid, and you get a good wine. But our wine is a quality wine that could be compared, for example, $25, $30 California wine, because once you get into $10, $15 in California, you can't make $10 wine if your land costs $200,000.
No, you're 100%.
Mathematically
right.
not possible.
Right.
Right,
you have to do some shenanigans.
We're running out of time, so I want to get your last wine in that we're tasting today. Tell us what this one is.
This is fabulous.
Thank you. Okay, what do
I'm
we
not
have
spit bucketing that other stuff. I like it.
So this is the Imperial Red Blend. It's a majority Merlot.
Okay.
60% Merlot, 30% Cabernet, and then...
It smells like earth. Arts.
I mean, hey, this is 2011, okay?
Okay.
It's been aged in French oak for almost 9 months.
Oh, my God.
It's been in the bottle for almost 24 months.
It tastes almost like a spirit.
This is a... The quality-wise, this is a $30, $35 bottle that sells in DC Costco for $6.99 a bottle.
I can't believe it. It's amazing.
And people always go like, how do you do that? Well, A... Costco
okay.
made an offer.
We had no
fees.
Choice. Right.
Correct. And then B.
You make Costco sound like the godfather. But.
B, we don't want to gouge. We make enough. And the production cost as such, I mean, obviously, it's not going to cost $6.99.
It's not even that you don't want to gouge. And it's clearly, it's a volume play,
of
not
course.
A markup play.
No, no. It
it's
is
not a
volume
margin,
play.
You know.
This was selling it. I mean, Calvert Woodley Tom did a fantastic job buying this from us before Costco made that crazy offer.
Mm-hmm.
And he was selling it for $14.99 very successfully. And it was considered a good value. At $14.99.
Yeah. Well, and I think one of the things we've really have hit home today here on this show, because we've brought in other wine companies and winemakers before, one of the things that you have hit home is that just because a bottle of wine is inexpensive doesn't mean it's not good. And I do think in the DC region, you have a lot of people with a lot of money, and they assume that something can't be good for that price. And I just think that that's a fact. And you have to listen. We have been to dinner with people who think they know a lot about wine. And, you know, they would look at a wine list. And, you know, if there wasn't a bottle, because they're obnoxious and very wealthy, if there wasn't a bottle for $500 on there, they were like, I mean.
Are his initials BK?
Yeah, you know who it is. I mean, he was like, I mean, there's really nothing on this wine list.
You know,
and I was like, dude, then don't have anything.
A good,
I'm
this,
ordering a bottle.
This is a good, really, lesson in. Continue your wine education, because even if
absolutely.
You think you know, keep going, because you're going to find treasures. I mean, this wine is stunning.
Listen,
yeah, this wine is
we're
going to
be
good.
this is insane.
But the
it's 89
is my
points
favorite.
From Robert Parker. But let me tell you something. Next year,
you
gonna,
to it.
Next year we're going to do something crazy.
Tell us.
We're going to I can't fully disclose what we're going to be doing, but we're going to basically.
Does it involve nudity? That's
okay.
My,
we have like 3 minutes
oh,
left,
sorry.
So let him finish.
We're just going to. Continue the education, and we're going to disclose what we do, and we're going to help the consumer to understand what the wine is.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there is a lot of murkiness. People need to know what they drink. People need to know how many components of chemicals go into wine production in wines like Apothic or Kendall Jackson. I think we need to know. I'm not suggesting these are bad wines, but I want them to know what the ingredients are, why they're drinking, how much residual sugar there is. I want to know, because I'm a health freak, why wine should be excluded from cheese or from cosmetics. We need to know what the ingredients are, and we're working towards it.
Well, I think that's an excellent point, because you're 100% right. Just because somebody like Kendall Jackson or one of the bigger wine houses or regions has the money to invest in the marketing, doesn't mean what they're pouring is actually good. I mean, we always compare it to like Dom Perignon, right?
Yeah. So
Dom Perignon has a massive, massive marketing account. So everybody knows it. But there are fabulous smaller grower champagnes that are all over the region that are a quarter of the cost that are incredibly tasting wine.
You're absolutely correct.
So, I mean, same thing here. So the show's over. But we want to thank you for coming in today.
What? Go to gmbimporters.com.
Absolutely. I was going to ask Robert to tell us that.
Well, I know the answer.
Okay, go ahead.
And you can see the complete lineup there and find out what all the retailers where you can, you know, and the restaurants where you can get it.
Absolutely. And if you haven't expanded your palate and tried wines from other countries, if you just sort of stick to your old-time favorites, this is your message. It is time to expand your palate, try new things. Definitely try some of these wines from Bulgaria and try wines from other countries that you're not familiar with. The more you taste, the more your palate grows. And these are exceptionally good on the pocketbook, which during this time of the year is a very good thing. These make an excellent gift, I want to add, especially for housewarming and holiday parties.
So I want to thank my Gamza for all the condescension.
Yes, you're very welcome.
And Robert for coming in, Robert Hike for coming in with all these great wines.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you so much, guys, for your
forum. May G&B rule the waves.
Thank you.
And we want to thank Robert for coming in, all these delicious wines. And I'm just looking up who is on next week. Oh, Philip Glass is coming in next week. He has a new book all about spirits. I assume he's bringing cocktails, so it's going to be a pretty tasty show. We want to thank you for joining us today. You know you can hear us on Foodie and the Beast on Sundays. You can hear us here live
tell
at the Line
on 1500 AM on broadcast radio.
Yes, it's a 10-year-old show. We just celebrated 10 years.
She acts like a 10-year-old on
my
that
God,
show.
Can you shut up, please, and let me just finish what I'm saying?
Do
you
want
to just
fun.
End the show? Why don't you end the show?
I'm going to end the show. Great. So listen to us on 1500 AM live every Sunday. It's like a variety show. It's a lot of fun. And Robert, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate your support, guys. Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher. And our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.